Welcome to Talkin' Music here on KVNF. I'm Corey Stanton. This week on Talkin' Music, I spoke with Ellen Sander, author of Trips, Rock Life in the 60s. Ellen and I spoke about her book tour, Jimi Hendrix, and what it was like being a rock journalist in the midst of rock and roll.
I'm Ellen Sander, and I am a poet and a journalist living now in Belfast, Maine, by way of New York, Bolinas, California, Los Angeles, California, and Beijing, China. And I'm here on a book tour for the reissue of my book, Trips, Rock Life in the 60s, which was originally published in 1973. It was written in 1969, 1970, 1971. And it was about my experiences as a rock journalist in the very earliest days of rock journalism, the mid-late 60s. I was based in New York, but of course I traveled all over and saw a lot of what turned out to be very iconic musical moments. And I was lucky that I wrote them all down at the time because memory isn't what it used to be. I'm a little old lady of 75 right now. And I added some things to the reissue, which were footnotes to each chapter, just looking back on them, how it all sorted out for me since then, because I didn't want to really change the voice of the original writing. Added a couple of chapters. So I'm here on a book tour that is invited here by Rick Stockton of the Scones, a wonderful band that I play on the radio in my radio show in Belfast, Maine, in our 100-watt light bulb station. And I'm happy to be here. It's good to be here. We had a little tour around today. It's so beautiful.
Well, great. We're happy to have you here and welcome to the North Fork Valley. Did you grow up listening to music? What did you hear around the house?
Around the house, they played like 20s and 30s music. Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree with Anyone Else But Me was one of the first songs I learned as a toddler.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me.
And my father loved classical music. And then as the years went by, we got a television. It was the 50s, and there was a show on called My Hit Parade.
Your Hit Parade.
And it had Perry Como and Dean Martin and Connie Stevens and all of those people from kind of that transition, that pop transition. It wasn't really rock and roll yet. And then the rock and roll hit in the mid-50s. And the whole high school I was in, you know, just kind of erupted with it. So listen to the AM radio, Fats Domino and Buddy Holly and just that era of groups. And then that separated us from the adults loving that kind of music. Elvis Presley. I remember my mother looking at Elvis Presley and says, you know, he has a better voice than most of them, but I don't know about, you know, the way he performs. It's not like anything I've seen before.
Pretty provocative.
Yes.
When did you first slip into music? Like the first time you experienced maybe losing yourself into music?
I think it had to be pretty early on because I always loved music. I don't think I can point to an exact moment. I think where I slipped into being committed to it as a profession and a life was at the Monterey Pop Festival, and that was in 1967.
And how old were you?
23.
Wow. Do you want to talk about some highlights?
It was the first gathering of major talent in the rock and roll world, in the pop world, and the organizers were Lou Adler, Michelle Phillips, Paul Simon. So they pulled together like a lot of incredible acts, and it was a wonderful scene in Monterey, California. It was a beautiful place and beautiful weather, and it was in July. I think it was over Father's Day weekend, and they had everybody from Ravi Shankar to the Grateful Dead. I saw The Who, I saw Jimi Hendrix, I saw the Mamas and the Papas. I think actually my favorite moment was Otis Redding's set, which is not what people really want to hear. They want to hear, you know, about the more prominent white bands. I mean, I saw The Byrds and Janis Joplin with Big Brother, the original. But Otis Redding played at night, and it seemed like one act just built on the other, and there was so much excitement. And he just came out, and he consolidated it. All the celebrities came out from the backstage tent to watch him and to just kind of groove along with him, and he sang Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. And I really think, for me, You know, I've written a lot about watching The Who and Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, the Jefferson Airplane, all of those people. But the Otis Redding set for me really is the one that kind of set itself in my heart.
Was this a writing assignment for you, or were you just...
I didn't have an assignment, but I ended up writing 3 or 4 pieces on it when I got home, because by that time I'd already had a few bylines and people kind of trusted that I can come up with a report.
Yeah, and how was it meeting these musicians?
I had met some of them before. They were busy. I was busy observing. They were busy doing what they did before, during, and after their sets. And so I just kind of watched them. I didn't interact that much because I just thought it was more fun to watch what they were doing, watch how they related to what they were doing, watch how they reacted when they saw the other performers.
So you must be pretty inquisitive.
Yes, I would say that's probably one of my main driving forces.
Me too. I mean, you've met and worked and interviewed some amazing people, musicians, icons, music
yes.
icons, including John Lennon.
Yes.
Can you recall your interview with John Lennon?
It was up in Canada, and Alan Klein was the manager of all the Beatles at the time, and I guess we had made the acquaintance, and he called me and said, did I want to come up there and interview him? And I thought I was going to fly up, interview, and fly back. But they put me up at the hotel, and I stayed there for the entire time that they stayed there. I even babysat for Kyoko while they went to try to get a visa to get into the States. He was very open. First of all, I was struck by the fact that I didn't think that he was as young as people said he was. He seemed a lot older to me. He seemed to have some age on him. At first, I just loved hearing the sound of his voice speaking, and I would just ask questions that would take a long time to answer, just like really listening to John Lennon's speaking voice. And he was very forthcoming and open. He had these ideas, you know, these very idealistic ideas that, you know, the world should change and there should be no weapons and no more war. And that's his message. He wants peace and he wants to travel around the world giving concerts and talking about peace. And he couldn't get into the U.S. They wouldn't give him a visa because he'd had a drug bust. That was the excuse. But I think they were politically afraid of him. And they had every right to be politically afraid of him. Eventually did get in, but that was kind of what the camping out in Canada. They gave a peace concert in Toronto, and Eric Clapton was there, and Yoko was on stage. That was really a lot. Oh, and Little Richard was there. And little Richard said, you may be the king of the rock and roll, but I'm the queen. And John, they were shaking hands, and John took his other hand and slapped Little Richard's hand and just laughed his head off.
Were you writing for a particular publication?
I was at that time writing regularly for Saturday Review, so I wrote it up for them. And then I took the transcript of the interview and published that in the LA Free Press, and that's reprinted in my book.
Very cool. Were you ever nervous to meet such eminent musicians?
No. They knew what they were doing. I knew what I was doing. It was a really clear kind of situation where I'd come into interview or to hang out while they performed, and they were there to answer my questions and kind of give me some insight into what their creative process was and what their sense of their career was.
Who's your target audience for trips? Who should read this book?
Gee, that's a good question. Everybody, you know. I guess I'll just find that out. I mean, I know a lot of people who read the first book or buying the second one just to see the difference in the update. But I'm getting a lot of people reaching out from, I just got a message today from somebody who publishes a groupie zine who wants an interview. So I guess there's that. And there's the people who love that era of rock and roll, mostly, I think. Maybe some of the people who love that era of rock and roll who weren't around to experience it because they weren't born yet. I guess that might be interesting to them. I'm always curious to find out, you know, with so much contemporary music around, what's your interest in this, you know, in this era of music?
Oh, the classics, man.
Yeah.
Well, you kind of touched on this just in the evolution of how music has changed, but over your entire career and experience, what has changed the most in music from your perspective?
Well, when it went from, you know, that kind of classic rock, and then it kind of got too corporatized and it started losing momentum and losing essence, I think. Then punk came up and I was like, what the F? I mean, Lou Reed, I understood. Patti Smith, I understood. The Ramones, I understood. None of them really felt like they were punk. They just got labeled that because there was this punk movement. But when these real punk bands started coming out, you know, in New York, somebody said, well, you go to see CGBGs and you'll see what we mean. And I have to say this. I don't get it, and I don't want to. Enough for me.
Yeah, fair enough. The word rebellion is written numerous times in Trips. Can you describe what that word means to you?
Okay, I really can, because I think when, during the kind of Fats Domino, Buddy Holly, Elvis Presley, Chubby Checker, James Dean era of rock and roll, was a definite feeling of this is the entertainment we love, and part of the reason we love it is because it separates us from our parents. It separates us from the music that is being played mostly on the radio. It separates us from the mainstream. It's ours. So that was really part of it. There was a movie called Rebel Without a Cause, and there were riots, not terrible riots, but people would just like get up and yell and scream and stomp. They didn't, you know, do destructive things. You know, this was a social phenomenon. Now, you have this generation that somehow by instinct knows it's a very, very large generation, these baby boomers, and they're just coming of age. They're coming into their teen years. They're getting in and out of high school, and they are feeling a certain amount of power that they want to exert on their world, on their scope of morals, on their scope of aesthetics. So that's what I refer to as rebellion.
Did you ever take a break from writing about music?
Well, I did. Maybe a year after Trips came out the first time, I had started a family. I had moved out of a big city and into a small rural town with a lot of hipsters. And my life was really changing. And I took a break from writing music for a while.
And then you went back to it?
No, I never did.
Oh, you never did?
I know I never did. I got into poetry.
Well, you kept writing.
I kept writing, of course, but I wasn't writing about music.
Yeah. But things sound like they changed and family changes.
Yes, definitely family changes and also just changes in ideas. And also I didn't relate that much to that kind of, you know, 70s seemed like very remnants, like the late 70s. And then after that, well, you know, there were a few things in that little shimmer of time where Blondie came out, but it just didn't seem that substantial to me. And I was by that time much more into my own writing about my own perceptions without relying on something outside, you know, to focus it on.
Yeah. Well, what was it like being a woman writing in the 60s? And how have you seen women in historically male-dominated industries or jobs evolve over the last 40 or 50 years?
There were not that many people writing about rock and roll to begin with, and very few of them were women, maybe a handful. Evelyn McDonald, who's an acquaintance of mine, published two volumes of women who write about rock and roll, and there's just dozens and dozens of them. So the number has increased, and obviously the acceptance by the publishing and now either online publishing or paper publishing has increased. So they probably outnumber the men now.
Yeah. What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced over your career?
Well, at first, trying to make ends meet, you know, trying to get enough work to keep the house and home together. I mean, there was so much to write about. It was like getting to it all was a big, big challenge.
How did you do your research? I mean, now we can just Google, we can YouTube, we can Wikipedia. How did you?
I just asked people. You know, when I need education about the jazz or the blues or whatever, I just asked people. Like Bobby Columbi, who was in Blood, Sweat, and Tears, we were talking and I didn't know a whole lot about the jazz thing. So he came over to my house with a bunch of John Coltrane records and said, borrow these for a while. Then, you know, everything you need to know about jazz. And then I'll give you some other artists. You know, so I just asked people. I was criticized a lot for not having a musical background or I didn't know what a hi-hat was. But now I know a lot more and I really feel like it doesn't make a difference because I wasn't going on the background information, what I was doing. I was pretty much responding in the moment. That was my style to what I was experiencing and feeling and thinking and projecting.
Yeah, really, this behind-the-scenes look into these musicians' lives and routines. And
just the response to the music, which I really think was kind of a feminine way of writing about it. It's just like what my response is. Because most of the musicians were men, so there was just that kind of appeal. Mm-hmm.
If you attended a concert, where would you usually be standing? Were you on the side? Or were you in the crowd?
I would be sitting pretty far forward in the venue, or I would be standing backstage. But most of the time, I'd just be sitting, you know, like in the Fillmore East or other clubs or whatever. I'd just be sitting, but had a pretty close view.
And would you write while you were there? Or would you just take it in and then you would...
No, I would remember. I would go right home and write. Even if there was like a party afterwards, I would go home first and, you know, make some notes. Just sit somewhere quiet, make some notes, and then go to the party. And it was those notes that carried me into developing articles and reviews.
When you think about all the women in music that you interviewed or spent time with over your career, who stands out to you as a strong woman who is helping pave the way for women today?
Well, I'd have to say Laura Nyro, who was a friend. So I don't remember ever like formally interviewing her. I met her when she was 19 years old, and she was an incredible writer. And she didn't follow any rules about composition, did she? I mean, you know, change times, change tempos, change instrumentation all in the same song. She had an incredible idea about production. She would drive engineers crazy, but I think her work was seminal and phenomenal and never appreciated enough. I interviewed Cass Elliot. That's the only time I ever spent with her, was like that 60 or 70 minutes. I got a great feeling about how strong she was, how self-aware she was. To answer your question, that those would be the only two. There were not a lot of women, you know, in the business of rock and roll. There were some in groups and stuff. You know, in that era, there were not a lot of women.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Talkin' Music here on KVNF. I'm Corey Stanton, and I recently spoke with Ellen Sander, author of Trips, which covers her journey as a rock journalist in the 60s. Stay tuned. What is your anthem?
Well, sometimes it's Mr. Tambourine Man. Sometimes it's Sympathy for the Devil. Sometimes it's California Dreamin'. Sometimes it's, what an interesting question. Back in the High Life Again. Sometimes it's Dear Mr. Fantasy. Sometimes it's In My Life.
Yeah. I don't know that I could name this one either.
So much of it, you know, I'll be listening to the radio and something will play that I hadn't thought of in a long time and I'll go, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you write poetry.
I do.
Have you written anything recently that you want to share with us?
Oh, let me see. I'll find something. Yeah. This one's called Not About You. The clearly soon to be famous singer said, in a crowd this size, there's bound to be someone I slept with. So I just want you to know this is not about you. I never thought it was about me, but I looked over at my date, who was laughing much too hard. This is one called Angie Bowie. This is about women in the business. Angie Bowie, deep knee bends in high heels, high hells. Tina Turner's bruise, Cheetah Rivera's spider kisses, wise wounds on fire. I wrote this about the Troubadour Bar. The Eagles Sad Cafe is about the Troubadour Bar in Los Angeles on Doheny and Santa Monica. And I wrote this quite a while ago, and it's called Star City Lights. Sex isn't everything, Diane, he said. Oh, yes, it is, she replied, leaving the Troubadour Bar with a semi-famous musician. Looking at him, I couldn't believe her eyes. Love isn't blind. It's just naked and needy now and then. It must be the wine or the Panama red or the Star City beat pressing swinging doors behind the bouncer with the bulbous arms, gold chain, and gleaming dome. He is a eunuch guarding the rock and roll harem. He calls the well-heeled when their favorite prey comes to water. He passes the most golden of bodies on to one another. High cheeks, long curly hair, hips just so, eyes like rockets. Finery loves finery. Their prowling caresses rustle in satin and suede. He slaves the glitzy riffraff for the rest, like Diane. When it gets this late, no one goes home hungry. He doesn't save one for himself. He loves only cocaine. and knows a good seat is worth $100 in a night of infamy.
I love that you're still kind of inadvertently writing about music.
Not often, but I went over a few of them to bring along. Most people like poetry about something they're familiar with.
This is the 50th anniversary of the original Woodstock Festival, which you attended and covered in your book. What are your thoughts on trying to recreate the festival in 2019?
Well, it's certainly gone through some controversy now. It's more interesting to talk about than it otherwise would have been. You can't recreate the original because the elements that went into that were so volatile, you know, and they just happened to work, and it was so amazing. The Stones tried to recreate it with Altamont, and, you know, it just fell apart for a lot of different reasons. But that many people listening to music and enjoying music in that and the community that created, and they survived the bad weather and the lack of conveniences, and it was just an amazing thing, and you'll never recreate that again. Now, as far as recreating the roster of talent, I think they gave it a good try to, because now festivals are a little more common in the United States, to get a good list of people to play, but apparently they have run into major business obstacles right now. And the festival, at least the one Watkins Glen, that's being produced by one of the original co-producers of the original festival, is in deep, deep doo-doo.
Wow. I guess I didn't realize that they were trying to recreate this.
They were not trying to recreate it. They're trying to, you know, build on the cachet of it and put on a good festival where people can come and have a good time. I'm all for that. I think people have a good time. People have a good time at Coachella. So they say. I like the idea of a festival of a lot of groups and a lot of people and, you know, good food and camaraderie and all that. If it's not too over-commercialized, it usually works out all right. But, I think there's every reason to want to commemorate Woodstock 50. We're going to do it in our little town. We're going to have a special reunion of all the people in town who went to Woodstock together.
You reported on the 1965 Newport Folk Festival where Bob Dylan went from playing as an acoustic solo to having an electric band, which seemed to be a turning point at the time. Were you actually at that event?
No, I researched that. I talked to people and I researched that. I even talked to Dylan about it.
Oh, was he a nice guy?
He's a very shy guy. So you have to catch him where he doesn't feel like you're going to be fawning all over him or that you're going to, like, be all over him for what does this line in this 40-year-old song mean. So, you know, to just sit and talk, he's okay. People come unglued around Dylan. I've seen this happen. They just kind of fall apart. They start talking to him in his own voice. I mean, it's just very, very strange. But I was able to relate to him in a very casual situation in my own home at the kitchen table.
Mm-hmm. I was more comfortable.
Yeah. And his opinion of that whole thing is that he thinks the reaction to it was a little over the top, mm-hmm. You know. And my reaction is like, he was the headliner. He should have done something spectacular. He was the headliner of the festival for the first time, you know.
Did you find that people were very candid and honest with you?
Most of the time.
Could you tell if someone was kind of being phony?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are things people don't want to talk about, and they will, you know, all of a sudden get very roundabout in their responses. But most of the time, people were pretty candid.
Mm-hmm. From reading the first chapter of Trips, you talk about coming of age in the late 1950s. From your viewpoint, what do you think distinguishes your generation from previous generations and even later generations?
The bomb, the atomic bomb, the notion that the whole world could go away immediately, suddenly, violently, the whole world. Nobody ever had to deal with that before. No adult, no child, no teenager. And so we were dealing with a student rebellion in Hungary that was put down very violently. We were never aware of that kind of political violence in the world before. I mean, we had heard about Stalin and everything, but that was kind of history, that it would happen to kids our age, to high school kids and college kids in Hungary, which we didn't even know where it was until that happened. So I think that galvanized us politically in a way that other generations hadn't been. Then we had this, television was just kind of coming up. So our rock stars were on television. It connected us even further like that. FM radio came along, and that sealed the deal.
Are there any songs that helped you get through those kind of moments?
All of them. All of them. They were of great comfort. They were very outspoken songs. They said, "We know what hurts you. We know what's wrong. We feel the same way. We want to do something about it. You can do something about it." So, you know, that's to me kind of the overriding messages of most of the songs. And also a new literature, new vocabulary of music, I think, was being created at that time, which we felt very, very attached to. We felt a certain amount of ownership of.
You were resonating with these lyrics and maybe just the emotion of the music.
Yes. And first of all, you know, lyrics were very important. I mean, recordings were mixed so you could hear the words. You know, it wasn't all this pounding. And it was a very intimate relationship, intellectually, emotionally, physically, spiritually. And it was very intense for a while.
Yeah. What words of wisdom do you have for an aspiring rock writer today?
Don't be afraid to express passion along with analysis. It's very important. People who love rock feel very passionately about it. So follow your passion and then your research and then your analytics, but do not ever be afraid to rely on passion to get you through what you're writing.
Also, hearing you talking, when I asked you if you were ever nervous, you said no immediately. And to me, that conveys confidence.
I felt very comfortable. I felt very motivated. I felt like I was on a mission. I didn't do very well in school. I wasn't really sure what I was supposed to do with myself. And all of a sudden, the only thing I was confident with was I knew what to do with myself. And then as far as figuring out how to do it, I just figured it out as I went along because there was no infrastructure for being a rock journalist.
During your time as a journalist, you attended innumerable rock concerts. And I'm sure you get this question a lot, but is there one that stands out to you in particular?
I do get that question a lot, and it's very, very hard to answer. I can just, every once in a while, I think of one. So I'm going to think of one for you, and it would be Thanksgiving, probably 1969, but it could have been 1968. It was at Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts in New York, and the bill was Donovan and Jimi Hendrix. And I looked at this bill, and I went, what were they thinking? Donovan and Jimi Hendrix. It was so good. Donovan was incredible. The acoustics in that room are incredible. And he was just in great voice. And, you know, he's just such a love child. And you just have to, like, let go of any skepticism. It was so good. And then Jimmy came on and just tore it up. And they seemed to complement each other perfectly. You would think that, you know, we should book them with a blues band or something. But no, it was amazing. It was Thanksgiving weekend.
Wow. And had you seen Jimi Hendrix before? Were there times after that?
Yes, I saw Jimi Hendrix the first time in the summer of 1967 at the Monterey Pop Festival. And then I went to see him every single time I could afterwards. He was incredible. He did so much for evolving the role of the guitar. I mean, the guitar always was a central instrument in rock and roll. I'm not saying in that way, but this, what sound you could get out of the guitar. Les Paul invented the electric guitar and through several models produced certain sounds that acoustic guitars couldn't do even if they were mic'd. What Jimi Hendrix did evolved it as much as Les Paul did, and then everybody followed. He did all of those sound effects, that buzzing, that ringing, that picking, that I don't even know how to explain all the sounds that he got out of the guitar. No pedals, okay? No gadgets. He did all that in the instrument. He'd hold the instrument and shake it to make it tremolo. He'd bite it with his teeth. He'd play it behind his head. Okay, that's a trick, you know, that he probably learned from Jerry Lee Lewis. But all that sound, all that distortion, all that incredible harmonics, he got out of the instrument with his body. And to me, that is phenomenal.
Do you think that there's anyone that compares?
It'd be hard to compare because everybody kind of, you know, grew from that. But I think Jimmy Page's guitar work is It's unbelievable, and Jeff Beck even more so. How Jeff Beck bends a note that far is beyond me. He must, like, you know, have a shovel or something. I mean, I've seen videos. I see him playing with this little, you know, handle, but he bends it like three octaves. And also, I love where Jeff Beck has gone with this music, that he'll do Over the Rainbow and do jazz standards, and that he remains pretty much in every band he is. He's the front person and the soloist. So, yeah. I suppose those two learned a lot from Jimi Hendrix and evolved things on their own. But, I mean, he was the basis for that kind of buzzy, twangy, percussive guitar sound that was still very melodic and had a lot of overtones and nuances in it.
Okay, how did you meet Rick Stockton?
Rick, I got an email one day from this man who had some question about something that I wrote in Hit Parader, which was one of my very first regular writing jobs. And we just got into conversations about it. And he had clippings of articles that had been lost, which he was kind enough to scan and send to me. So some of them are included in Trips, which wouldn't have been otherwise. And we just kept in touch on and off. And then when Trips was going to be reissued, he was one of the first people I told, because I knew he'd be interested. And so we were chatting, and he said, maybe you'd like to come out here for a book launch. And I went, yes, of course I would.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't want to come to Peonia for a book launch? I think, you know, there's a big story in rural music scenes. You know, even if most of the bands are working men's bands, there's always, especially in towns like this, when people are interested in the arts, there's time for the arts in a small rural town. And so arts flourish. And it's not just, you know, music, it's the visual arts as well, and the healing arts. And it's always amazed me. When I moved to Bolinas from Los Angeles, and that was like my first full-time residence, there were so many bands there. There were so many poets there. The poets owned a press. They would publish their own stuff. We had dances. We had events. We had concerts. You know, the Grateful Dead lived in the next town over in Stinson Beach, and they would sometimes come and jam, and not the whole band, but maybe, you know, Jerry or David. And there was so much music going on in this little, you know, the people in the cities would never hear of. It didn't matter to them. It didn't matter to us. It was just so vital. And I think that is a great thing to know about rural America, that the arts are thriving here.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about your book tour. And you're doing a book signing and a kind of Q&A over at the Blue Sage.
Yeah.
What do you enjoy about that kind of interaction?
I can ask people what they liked, you know, and get some feedback. Like if somebody comes up that's like 14 years old, I'm going like, okay, how did you get to this, you know? And it's nice meeting people who read your book and like it. Sometimes I even get things like, I read your book and it really made me rethink my whole life. You know, not often, but I think, you know, okay. Don't come to me when you want your life back. But so it's fun to actually meet people, because writing is a very solitary thing. I mean, I have my sweetheart, John, that I can run things through before I make a fool of myself. And he's wonderful about that. And he gives me a lot of feedback. But basically, it's a very solitary thing. So to have the opportunity now and then to get out and meet people who read and like what you do, it's more thrilling than reading a review or a Rolling Stone interview.
Yeah, and it's so personal. You're right there, and you can feel that connection with the person, mm-hmm. too, I'd imagine. And so where can our listeners pick up your book, or where can they order it?
Well, they can order it from any online book service, and Amazon right now is sold out for a couple of weeks, but they can get the ebook, and they can get it at local bookstores that carry it. All Barnes & Nobles have a few copies.
So you'll be at the Blue Sage Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m., and that's when you're going to be doing a Q&A, and you'll get to meet some other locals here.
I'm really looking forward to that meet and greet and reading to them. And also, I just saw the Blue Sage just now. I got a little tour of the town. It looks like a wonderful venue.
And you want to talk a little bit about where else you're traveling to next?
I'll be at Barnes & Noble in Grand Junction on Saturday, on May 18th at 2 o'clock.
Well, thank you so much for coming down to KVNF. We're so happy to have you.
Corey, it's been a great pleasure. And I listen to KVNF in Belfast, Maine, because I enjoy the station. I enjoy the playlists and the DJs, and you're lucky to have such a resource here.
Thank you. You've been listening to Talkin' Music on KVNF. I'm Corey Stanton. Thanks for listening.
In a young girl's heart, I
the music and